part by a grant from Birkenstock Concepts by Heel to Toe in downtown Urbana. For over 25 years, offering all sizes and widths of Birkenstocks, from clogs and sandals to work, dress, and sport shoes. Birkenstock Concepts offers repair and modification services and a certified podorthist and orthotist on staff.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. I'm Celeste Quinn, and my apologies this afternoon to our listeners. I hope you'll hang in there with us this afternoon. We're having a number of problems here this afternoon at the station, and rather than get into a discussion with the guest, Alan Metcalf, what we're going to do is go to the archives this afternoon, and we will reschedule this interview with Alan Metcalf for a later date, perhaps as early as Monday. Looking forward to this conversation. Alan Metcalf is a professor of English at McMurray College, and he is the author of several books on language. His latest is Presidential Voices, Speaking Styles, From George Washington to George W. Bush. Again, my apologies. We will reschedule the interview for a later date. In the meantime, we go to the archives, and we will rebroadcast an interview from July 1st of this year. Stay tuned. This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for joining us today. More than 40 million people are infected with HIV around the world. 25 million have died from AIDS. That, as our guest in this portion of the program notes, is more than all the battle deaths of the 20th century. Our guest this afternoon is Greg Berman. He is the author of The Invisible People. The title for the book comes from Ralph Ellison, who wrote The Invisible Man and said, "I am invisible, understand, simply because people refuse to see me." Today, with Greg Berman's help, we'll take a look at the global AIDS crisis and the U.S. response to the pandemic. Berman says America's response has been woeful to a disaster of such immense human misery. He also sees HIV and AIDS as threats to global security. He says, quote, "Beyond the ineffable human toll, the pandemic is refashioning the social, economic, and geopolitical dimensions of the world." Our guest, Greg Berman, is the coordinator for the Council on Foreign Relations Roundtable on Improving U.S. Global AIDS Policy. His book, and let me give you the full title, his book, The Invisible People, How the U.S. Has Slept Through the Global AIDS Pandemic, the Greatest Humanitarian Catastrophe of Our Time, is published by the Free Press, a division of Simon & Schuster. All proceeds from sales of the book, as well as the advance in royalties, are being donated by Greg Berman to an AIDS program in South Africa. Greg Berman, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
Now, when and how did you begin to realize that AIDS is a global crisis, a crisis of such magnitude?
Well, you know, I was studying international relations at Oxford University in a graduate degree, and I was very interested in this idea of new security threats. And in that context, I first stumbled upon some stories on the global AIDS pandemic and was just absolutely stunned to learn of the magnitude of the disease and what it was doing socially, economically, politically, particularly in sub-Saharan Africa. And it seemed so underappreciated. And then upon digging in a little bit, I realized that so little was being done, not only by leadership of countries that are most affected, but by the international community and the U.S., And this sort of question emerged for me, which is, what have we done about this over the past 20 years since we've known that it's global? And that question sort of became, what has the world's wealthiest, mightiest, most advantaged country done to address perhaps the greatest threat now known to mankind? And the book, The Invisible People, is sort of my answer to that question. It's sort of an examination of our failed response. And the idea was to try to sort of unearth the lessons and the themes which can help to chart a better course forward.
Yeah. Now, is this correct? As of just now, we're going to talk in a moment here about the Bush administration's initiative, but just a few years ago, the spending on AIDS and HIV, the richest countries of the world were spending about $300 million total.
Yeah, I mean, just, you know, next to nothing was being done about this, even as the disease exploded abroad through the 90s. During the 1990s, about 40 million people would become infected with HIV abroad, most punishingly in sub-Saharan Africa. During that time, there'd be about 1 million Americans infected. We came to spend in excess of $10 billion per year on the domestic epidemic and spent about, on average, $100 million per year on the global dimension, even as 40 million infections accrued throughout the decade. So we slept through the 90s, and the human toll has been enormous.
Why do you suppose we saw it strictly as a domestic issue and we hadn't opened our eyes to the situation around the world?
Well, you know, I think there's so many reasons. I think there's the idea that, antiretroviral drugs as sort of life-extending treatment really became available and, you know, were sort of, their efficacy was announced in 96 and they really had become proven and broadly available by 98. So through that, you know, people domestically really were focused on, what was going on domestically and trying to get, you know, treatment for people. There was the sense that this was happening in Africa, which is traditionally a neglected part of the world and has suffered enormously because of that. There was a sense that there were just other things going on in the world. There's the latency of the disease because there's a lag time between when people become infected and when they become sick and die. So that provides the perfect cover for politicians or policymakers who are disinclined to engage it or in denial because they're not seeing manifest sickness or death. But we are now, you know, in droves, and we've woken up with President Bush's plan, but we're still far short of where we have to be. And the plan is somewhat flawed for a few reasons. And what we need in general is a real viable long-term strategy as opposed to an emergency plan.
Yeah, okay. Well, we're going to spend some more time on that in just a moment. I think, though, it would be useful to do a little bit more background work here.
Yeah.
As you mentioned, we seem to think of it now, AIDS, that is, as most severe in Africa. Would you give us a sense of the situation in Africa? And then give us a sense of where else this is a crisis, India, Russia, and China.
Sure. Well, you know, to say that it's dire in sub-Saharan Africa is an understatement. There's some countries like Botswana and Swaziland that have adult infection rates of probably in the order of 35 to 40%. So soon, close to 2 in 5 adults, if they don't get treatment, will die of AIDS. Adult infection rates of 20, 25% are almost the norm throughout sub-Saharan Africa. It is, 8,000 people die of AIDS every day around the world. That's nearly 3 times 9/11's death toll every day. And so Africa is reeling socially. They'll begin to economically, and it'll have destabilizing effects politically. And what we're seeing now, much as African leaders sort of slept through the 80s and 90s, so too do we see Eurasia's leaders in essentially a state of denial about what's emerging there. And the pandemic's really poised to explode in places like India, China, and Russia. And the projections there are stratospheric. There was a cover article in Foreign Affairs Journal that projected that by 2025, there could be as many as 200 to 250 million newly infected people in those three countries alone. And if you look at Russia's 2003 budget for HIV/AIDS prevention, it was less than $1 million. And Putin has barely mentioned the term AIDS. So we are right now at a very seminal juncture in the evolution of this pandemic, where Africa is in desperate need of resources and attention, and the Eurasian leaders really have to wake up, and the U.S. and the international community can do a lot to get them to do that, because there's still so much that we can do to preempt what's about to happen there.
Yeah. Well, of course, the United States is the wealthiest nation in the world, so we're in a leadership position there. But also, it seems, in terms of what we know about the disease, we're also in a leadership position. We are, or some of the countries in the world now where AIDS is emerging as a crisis, these countries are They are worse off than we were in the 1980s, but they are also, in terms of attitudes and stigma, in terms of stigma, discrimination, they are where we were.
Yeah. I mean, there's a statement which I like and I think is apropos, and it's that, you know, history doesn't repeat itself, but rather leaders keep making the same mistakes. And it's played out to tragic effect in countries that have been affected by this disease. In the 80s, you know, Reagan and Bush 1 were, you know, pretty close to inert as the toll escalated at home. And the same thing happened to an even greater extent in Africa in the 80s and 90s. Although, Africa was certainly less equipped and had much less resources and had a host of other, crises to deal with, probably to a greater extent than we did. And now you see it, as I said, in Eurasia. But you're right. You know, we are the wealthiest country. We're the most influential country. And we've had an experience with the disease, a very visceral experience. And as a result, you know, we host so much of the best science, public health experts, understanding of what has to get done. And the will amongst several people who've been experienced to try to do things. And I think that the combination really places us in a position to lead.
Mm. What lessons should we pay attention to now from, to date, the mishandling of global AIDS?
I think probably from the U.S. perspective, it's that if there's probably the biggest lesson is that we've just been, 10 years behind the curve. And what you see through the history, and the book takes you through this and the stories, is that we could have done so much at so many turns, and there were so many missed opportunities. And I think considering those and understanding them and now sort of realizing where we are now, and as I mentioned, this sort of seminal juncture where, so much needs to get done in Africa and so much can be done in Eurasia to preempt what may happen. And instead of sort of continuing to remain behind the curve, which we are with our current policy, to really use this moment to try to get ahead of the curve and to front-load resources and diplomatic engagement and will. And, we know what to do. You know, there are success stories, Uganda, Brazil, Thailand, Senegal, where national leadership leads and makes the resources available to combat the epidemic. We can curb it. And so those success stories, ring out loudly, and the U.S. and the international community can do so much to press leaders to engage and to make the resources available so that they can do it. And we have a historic opportunity to save millions, maybe tens of millions of lives.
Hmm. Prevention, research, testing, treatment, these things all leap to mind as necessary elements of the fight. What do we need to get these things done? What do we need to do to get mobilized?
Well, I think we need a healthy dose of political will. And I think that, governments have to lead, but there's so much that people can do as well. We are, one of the lessons that emerges from the book also is that, lest we need to be reminded we're a democracy. And, if to a certain extent, if our leaders are remiss, it'll be because we're letting them be. We need a much greater degree of political pressure from the groundswell, from the ground, from different constituencies to try to generate a groundswell and to hold leaders accountable and to not only let leaders know that now that we've woken, we need a sustained effort, that it has to get taken to the next level. So I think really a greater degree of attention, awareness, political pressure will help mobilize political leaders to really see the enormity of this and that the American people not only have an appetite for engagement, but demand it.
Hmm. In my introduction, I shared with listeners your statement about AIDS and global security, about its impact on the social, economic, and geopolitical dimensions of the world. Maybe it would be helpful for listeners if we took some time and kind of fleshed those dimensions of the AIDS crisis, fleshed them out a little bit.
Sure. Well, I think, it differs in geography. I think, though, if you take sub-Saharan Africa, where, as we've mentioned, to date, the pandemic has hit hardest. And, I met with one executive mayor who, in a region in South Africa, and her population's about 1 million people, and she told me that in a couple years, it was possible that her entire population of 1 million people would be composed of people who were either unemployed, infected with HIV/AIDS, or employed to care for people infected with HIV/AIDS. So that is an AIDS economy. And when you look at 20, 25, 30, 35% adult infection rates and how debilitating that is, and that some companies are training 2 or 3 workers for every one job, it's going to, you know, create unsustainable economic pressures. And when you combine that with the misery and the poverty and the other health challenges, you know, state institutions will really begin to crumble. And you see some of it already. And you have to worry about state capacity and the idea of failed states, particularly when terrorism is an enormous problem and underappreciated problem in sub-Saharan Africa. We can, you know, recall the embassy bombings in Kenya and Tanzania, and that Al-Qaeda operates in eastern Africa, and that Osama bin Laden spent a good portion of the 90s in Sudan. And there we see that there is, you know, in Afghanistan, we learned the lesson of a failed state, and in sub-Saharan Africa, we confront the potentiality of a failed subcontinent. And there, I think the security implications are evident. And in Eurasia, you know, this will, the toll, if, you know, estimates prove out, and there are tens of millions, 20, you know, scores of millions, maybe even hundreds of millions of infections, it's going to have huge economic implications that will reverberate throughout the global economy. And in places like Russia and India may even have a security impact. These are large countries with nuclear weapons. They're important. We have a very important strategic relationships, and AIDS is going to create social, economic, and political pressures in those countries.
So ultimately, it could become a defense issue as well.
I think it already has, and we're going to see. You know, you see it being talked about a little bit more, but. George Tenet has acknowledged it. The former CIA director, Colin Powell, acknowledges it. Colin Powell said things like global AIDS is the greatest weapon of mass destruction on Earth. The Washington Post has called it perhaps the most underestimated enemy of all time. So the language is really there, but the will and the vision to treat it in all of its dimensions, based on the priority that it really deserves because of the human toll and because of the broader implications, is not there. And the price to be paid is great.
Yeah. You quote from one of the editorials that you quote from in the book, The Invisible People, is from the Washington Post almost 2 years ago now, when the editorial team wrote, a century from now, when historians write about our era, one question will dwarf all others, and it won't be about finance or politics or even terrorism. The question will be simply, how could our rich and civilized society allow a known and beatable enemy to kill millions of people? Is that beginning to come to light? Is that beginning to sink in, do you think?
Well, again, the language is, Sebastian Malaby, I believe, wrote that editorial, and it was a brilliant piece. And the language you hear from politicians like Bill Frist and President Bush and others is really very strong and seems to recognize this as a historical emergency of really unprecedented proportions. But, you know, again, I think with this emergency plan, there's the sense that all that we need to do is being done. And it's perhaps in part maybe because, you know, we've sort of been so comparative in the way that we judge our efforts. We sort of say, well, Bush has done better than Clinton, and, you know, funding's increasing year over year. But of course, that's not really the best comparison to make, is our effort compared to what really has to get done. And if you make that comparison, we're very, very short. And you know, we've been talking about the problems and the human toll, and it's very important to understand that. But there's such good news, and the good news is that we have these success stories, and that we know so much about what to do, and we have the means and the competencies to do so much, to save so many millions of lives. And it's an extraordinary historical opportunity. You know, we needn't risk one American life to do this. It's just a matter of resources, a matter of time, and a matter of will. And I think that's why I remain optimistic.
Hmm. Well, what stands in the way of repeating success stories?
I think, you know, as we talked about earlier, the same cycle of leadership neglect, and again, a lack of resources. You know, there's some countries in Southern and Central Africa that are spending two or three times their debt service payments or interest on debt as they are in their entire budget for national health. You know, a good part of it is sort of just leadership, you know, negligence, but a good part of it is also that these countries are so resource-starved and so poor. And I think that the U.S. and the international community can do so much by making a greater degree of resources available. And I think that probably the best thing that we can do is, because health systems are so starved, is to really try to help these countries build sustainable health infrastructure so that they can deal not only with AIDS, but their other health crises.
Hmm. Infrastructure is a huge issue, isn't it?
It is. It's, you know, when you look at advanced Western economies, we spend something like $3,000 or more per person per year on national health. When you look at, you know, a lot of sub-Saharan African countries, they spend, you know, that might be $5 per person per year. Ethiopia spends $1 per person per year. So these countries essentially are the shells of national health systems. And it's not, you know, vastly sophisticated, impossible things to do. It's as simple as sort of getting, you know, functioning basic clinics, basic delivery systems, importantly, the people trained who can sort of do the healthcare work, the basic administrative work in these places. And, you know, we know that can get done. What we just, again, need is sort of the will to invest and do it up front so that these countries can really reap the benefits in a sustainable way.
Yeah. These programs that are successful, how long does it take to get them up and running?
Well, it differs depending on, you know, geography and context in certain places where there is a good deal of capacity. And that's important to understand as well, that there is a lot of capacity that's not being utilized. And I've spent time in Southern Africa and Botswana, and I've seen that. So, you know, there are certain groups that could use lots more in the way of resources today that aren't getting them. So those are the groups that we have to go to first, and that the administration is doing, I think, a commendable job of working hard to try to find those groups. And it is a challenge. So some can receive the funding and not have to break stride. In other parts of the world, it'll take more time, and people will have to emerge that can help lead these efforts, and we'll have to use U.S. capacity and U.S. agencies and NGOs to work with them. But, you know, this is very, very doable stuff, and that's the good news.
Hmm. Greg Berman is our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. He's the author of The Invisible People, How the U.S. Has Slept Through the Global AIDS Pandemic, the Greatest Humanitarian Catastrophe of Our Time. Well, let's talk now about the Bush administration's initiative, $15 billion. You call it an emergency plan. What will it do? Where does it fall short?
Well, the plan's goals, which are commendable and if achieved would be wonderful, are to prevent 7 million new infections, to get 2 million people on treatment, and to care for 10 million people. And that's obviously wonderful stuff, and it can't be discounted. But, you know, in that time, in that five-year period, experts are estimating that there'll be tens of millions of newly infected people. Tens of millions will desperately be needing treatment, where our aim, so that if we do everything perfectly, we'll get to 2 million. And I think that will be challenging in and of itself, the way that the program is framed and set up. And so what we have to realize is that in 5 years we're gonna wake up and realize that we're a lot worse off even because of this pandemic than we were at the beginning, and that all what we had in place was an emergency plan, a great and important first step. But what's really needed is a much broader global strategy, where even as we do the emergency stuff, we also move to build sustainable health infrastructure, so that countries can own their response and use it to achieve progress in the long term, and also over a broader array of health problems, because malaria and TB and other problems are very acute in a lot of these hardest hit places. And if we just focus on AIDS, we'll find that, you know, those patients suffer, and you could get into a situation where it's not, you know, politically tenable. So we got to do a lot more, you know, and in order to do that, a more comprehensive program, we need to front load the resources, and at the same time, we need a recalibrated level of diplomatic engagement at the presidential and cabinet level. You know, our leadership now has said that this is one of our biggest global challenges, and we now have to afford it that level of priority.
Hmm. Let's talk with a listener. We're going to talk with a caller on the toll-free line in Belgium, Illinois. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. It'd be interesting to point out that the situation could have been handled and improved a lot better than where we are today if we wouldn't have had the reticence of the Reagan administration that did not want to do anything as far as the AIDS epidemic because it's a connection with the homosexuality, which is such a sad statement. And also being the Republican Party, it makes me wonder just how much Mr. Bush is really going to do in this area.
You're right to point it out. And the book really begins in around 1983, when the first sort of U.S. official realizes that there's a really important global dimension to this. And the Reagan administration passes the buck, and it was very colored by a series of people in the administration who just didn't want to touch this because it was considered to be sex, it was considered to be homosexuality, prostitution, IV drug use, things that that administration did not want to deal with, and we weren't dealing with it domestically at home, let alone abroad at that point. And that was, you know, our response from the get-go, and we were obviously very far short. And I think that the way that we, certain people, certain leaders and the American public have conceptualized this has affected our ability to respond to the global dynamic, as well, the global dimension as well. And so you see a pattern of poor leadership starting from Reagan, carrying through to Bush 1, and you see it through the Clinton administration as well. Clinton was, you know, emerged as a likely leader on this issue, and he addressed the world AIDS crisis in his very first inaugural address, but for essentially 7 years, he did essentially nothing to try to upgrade our funding, our policy. And so you're right to point out that, you know, Reagan did not do a good job of this at the get-go, and you see that carrying forward until really this 2 years into the Bush administration with its emergency plan. And I think that we've woken up to it with this emergency plan, but again, we're maybe 10 years behind where we have to be, and it's time to get ahead now.
Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you.
Also, through each administration, from Reagan until now, where we have the second Bush in office, there have been political emergencies. At the time of the emergence of AIDS, and we're seeing in the early 1980s, we're still in the midst of the Cold War, and the Reagan administration is focusing on the Soviet Union, the evil empire. And through each administration, there have been situations that were politically they were the hot topics.
Yeah,
hasn't that also? I mean, and today we've seen the September 11th, the war in Afghanistan, Iraq.
You do. You're absolutely right. And the book works hard. I worked hard to make it, and sometimes the book was working hard to make me work hard. But you see, I try to sort of really flesh out the context because I think it matters. And you're right, you know, we were in the Cold War and we weren't really looking at these sort of transnational threats. The idea that health, that we had to really focus on international health and that it might even have broader economic or security implications was quite ahead of its time, was essentially foreign. And then you move into Bush, the one administration, with, you know, another war and the New World Order, that, you know, the Cold War was ending and managing all of that change. And then, you know, Clinton, there were various crises, and importantly, there was sort of Somalia, which was a debacle and cast a shadow over Africa, and you know, people were gun shy about engaging in Africa after that a little bit, which we saw to lethal effect in Rwanda. And you have other emergencies coming up. You know, Clinton is sort of politically besieged after he loses the midterm elections in his first term, and then you have the Lewinsky scandal and impeachment in 98. And context plays a big role, but I think also what you find is that there's always, you know, there's always something, there are always crises, mm-hmm. there's always a big challenge, and that, you know, I think when you don't want to do anything, these contextual factors can be excuses or rationalizations. And what's the bigger problem is the lack of willingness and vision to recognize the problem and to try to get ahead of it.
Yeah. Well, now on the table we have terrorism and the war in Iraq. We have a continuing situation in Afghanistan where things are unstable and insecure. We're headed toward an election. Where does global AIDS fit into the issues that are on the table in this election season, 2004? Is this an issue that we're going to hear more about in the months leading up to the election? And what's Kerry's position in terms of the global AIDS pandemic?
I think you will hear about it. It's a little unclear as to how much we will. I'm certain that we won't hear as much of it as we should. But I think we will hear about it because I think Bush considers this a great example of his, you know, this is sort of the compassion in his compassionate conservatism. You know, the emergency plan was announced even as the U.S. was marching towards a war that was deemed unpopular internationally. And the part of the idea, there were a lot of reasons why it happened, but one of them was surely because the administration really wanted to demonstrate American generosity and humanity, even as we were demonstrating American might and force to the world. And Bush, I think, considers it a big strength. There's a big address in this in an African-American church in Philadelphia a few days ago. But Kerry was a leader on this in the Senate before it became fashionable, if it is fashionable, but before it, you know, became got increased profile. He was a leader working with Bill Frist on the other side of the aisle. And the Kerry campaign, I don't believe that they have a detailed, confirmed plan of what they would do, but they have written that certain things, which suggest that funding will be considerably larger than what the Bush plan calls for. So there are certainly reasons to think that Kerry will be a leader on this. And I think one is that Richard Holbrooke is a very close foreign policy advisor, and he has been a very articulate and forceful advocate for this issue.
Mm. Who are the leaders in Congress on this issue?
Well, I think that in the Senate, they've been people like Kerry, Bill Frist, Hillary Clinton from New York speaks about this. People like Tom Daschle push for this. Pat Leahy from Vermont has been a very forceful spokesperson for this issue for a very, very long time. And in the House, you know, people like Nancy Pelosi, Jim McDermott from Seattle have been good on this. But I think that one of the things that people really can do is, you know, in Chicago is to call or write your political representatives, let them know that that funding is not where it should be, that the level of diplomatic and political engagement is not where it should be, and that people really care about this issue. I think this is, you know, the greatest moral challenge of our time, the greatest moral crisis of our time, and I think, you know, we can do a lot by being heard.
Hmm. Well, let's go back to maybe what we should be doing. You've mentioned we're 10 years behind. This is an emergency plan, the Bush administration $15 billion initiative. How much money should we be spending? What would a good plan look like, and how do you go? Like, let's go back to this idea in 1999. The richest countries of the world are spending $300 million on global AIDS.
Right.
Now we're zooming up to $15 billion. You know, in terms of
not annually.
Okay,
that's $15 billion is over
that's,
5 years.
That's
so that
right.
$3
okay,
billion
but
year.
Still, I mean,
right.
it's an order of magnitude.
A different leap, yes.
Yeah. So, you know, how do you you know, how do you rev this thing up so that you can do it and you can get, you can fight AIDS effectively, that you are, you know, making sure that all that money is going where it should be going. You know, we've got accountability here and we've got the infrastructure issue.
You do, and they're all challenges. But again, you know, the things that can work, providing treatment, increasing testing, increasing care, having more health workers around to do interventions, to provide that sort of stuff, more prevention messages, more counselors, all these things are quite simple, and we know what to do, and we know that they work. And WHO, the World Health Organization, has estimated that with in the order of $30 billion per year from the global community, after several years of effort, we could begin to save as many as 8 million lives per year. Now, when you boil that down and you say, what's the U.S. share? That's about $10 billion per year. And when you boil that down further and say, well, maybe we can finance some of that through debt relief or other ways, essentially it amounts to the price of two or three movie tickets per American per year. And then you remember that we have the opportunity that for that price to do all the things that could help to save millions and millions of people per year. And not to mention the human benefits, but also the economic, the security, the strategic benefits and our interests. And I think that that is just an incredibly compelling dynamic. And again, that's why I remain optimistic, because I think that the American people will support that. And it can be done.
Hmm. What about international organizations like the World Health Organization, like the United Nations, others? What's their history been in terms of responding to AIDS?
Well, you know, the book sort of tells the story, and it weaves in and out of from the U.S. perspective. It goes, you know, president's response and response among activists and diplomats and thinkers, and it also traces the response from the UN and WHO and UNAIDS, and sort of chronicles all the turf wars and the human dynamics. And I think WHO there was a great leader named Jonathan Mann in the mid to late 80s who was one of the most effective and charismatic global voices on this in the history of the pandemic. And the book tells his story, but then through, you know, turf wars and through politics and through personal rivalry, essentially man is forced to, or rather he's not forced to, but he decides that he has to submit his resignation, and so the world lost a great advocate and champion. And so, and you know, essentially what you have is this period from 1990 until 1998 where WHO is sort of floundering, and UNAIDS, which emerges as another international authority, only really finds its footing in 98. So you have this period of 8 years throughout the 90s mm-hmm. where the world doesn't really have an effective international authoritative body, advocating for action, talking about the magnitude of the disease, helping national leaders. And, you know, I think that is, you know, really helps explain, as well as other factors, the abdication in the 90s.
Mm-hmm. Are there turf issues here in the U.S.?
You know, absolutely. I mean, they're really, that thread weaved through the 20-year response mm-hmm. in the book, where, you know, who leads on this issue? You know, is it Health and Human Services in the U.S.? Well, they're primarily focused on domestic health. Is it CDC? Well, they're primarily sort of international surveillance.
Mm-hmm.
Is it the State Department, because it's a foreign policy issue? And, well, you know, they're not really equipped to do health interventions. And so for so long, all of these different parts of the government were passing the buck and weren't leading. Then in the late 90s, finally, you know, these disparate groups recognized the importance and began to emerge on this issue. And then what you actually had was sort of a rivalry, turf wars in the U.S. government over who can get the funding and who should do it and how it should work. And that was not helpful at all. I think what we have now is probably the best international framework or institutional dynamic in the U.S. government, where Randall Tobias is the U.S. Global AIDS Coordinator. He set up at the State Department, but has purview over a series of officials in different parts of the government who are working sort of, you know, loosely for him. And so there's a measure of institutional coherence for the first time, but I think there's also still a sense that we don't have enough manpower, administrative firepower, resources, and we'll have to, you know, the effort is still young, and we're going to have to see how it works.
Hmm. We're winding down here in terms of time. I know something that is near and dear to you, the situation of AIDS orphans, and the proceeds from your book are going to go to an organization called Heartbeat. First of all, let's talk about the situation of the children who are left behind as their parents are dying from AIDS. And what was it about Heartbeat that got you excited? And it's one of the reasons I'm sure that you're optimistic about what's happening.
Yeah, you know, you're right. And because, you know, even as you're disheartened at the inadequacy of our response historically and that we continue to remain behind the curve, and of course just all the suffering, when you spend time in these countries, you meet really extraordinary people who are working so hard to save lives and to salvage their communities, and you just know that, you know, you can do more to help empower them, and there are just so many courageous people out there, and that's one of the things that's just, you know, really wonderful. And, you know, to me, what this is doing to children is one of the most jarring aspects of this crisis. By 2010, it's estimated there'll be 25 million AIDS orphans. Now, that's, you know, the amount of all of the children under 7 years of age in the entire United States. It is a real calamity. And Heartbeat works in South Africa to help protect and care for AIDS orphans and kids who are heading their households, 12, 13-year-olds who are taking care of siblings after their parents have died, kids who are infected and sick. And essentially, they serve as the surrogate parents of those kids and just sort of breathe life back into them. They take care of them. They make sure they have everything they need. They give them ability to express themselves through drama and school. And it's just a wonderful group of people, very focused on doing great work. And I'm very proud that my proceeds are going to go towards Heartbeat.
Yeah. And also, before we go, tell us about the Council on Foreign Relations Roundtable.
Well, this was a roundtable that I worked on for the better part of the last year. A group of 30, 35 international and national policymakers, experts, thinkers on this issue, and we, the product of our meetings and our discussions and our working groups, was a report which we submitted to the administration and Congress and the media, outlining recommendations for improving U.S. global AIDS policy. And a lot of those we really touched on. It's the importance of thinking long-term, of building sustainable health infrastructure, thinking about providing greater amount of treatment to people, how we'll do it. And the other thing is, of course, the importance of science guiding policy as opposed to sort of social or religious dogma. What's important is that policymakers look at the science and the evidence and assess what works best and then be guided by that.
There we'll leave it. Greg, thank you very much for talking with us this afternoon.
Great to be with you.
Greg Berman has been our guest this afternoon here in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. He is the author of The Invisible People, How the U.S. Has Slept Through the Global AIDS Pandemic, the Greatest Humanitarian Catastrophe of Our Time. The book is published by the Free Press. It's a division of Simon & Schuster, and all proceeds from sales of the book, the advance and royalties, are being donated to an AIDS program, Heartbeat, in South Africa. And again, our thanks this afternoon to Greg Berman. He is coordinator of the Council on Foreign Relations Roundtable on Improving U.S. Global AIDS Policy. And let me just mention also that The Invisible People is a very compelling book, and it is very readable. It's a very moving history of AIDS here in the United States and around the world. And that interview was from July 1st of this year. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. We have rescheduled the interview that we had planned for this afternoon with Alan Metcalf about language and the presidency. His latest book is Presidential Voices, Speaking Styles from George Washington to George W. Bush. And we've rescheduled that interview for September 2nd. That's next Thursday. Meanwhile, he will be tonight in Springfield for a talk and a signing at Barnes & Noble at Veterans Parkway in Wabash. That event set for 7 p.m. this evening. That's the Barnes & Noble bookstore in Springfield, a talk and signing by Alan Metcalf. 9 minutes before 2 o'clock, settlement prices are in from the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Dave Dickey.
Thank you very much, Celeste, and good afternoon, everybody. Corn futures on the Board of Trade ended to the downside today, carving out two-week lows as speculative selling reemerged to pin prices in negative territory. Meanwhile, over in the soybean pit, we saw settlements sharply lower today as the market gnawed its way through technical support levels throughout this session and took back a large portion of the gains recorded on Monday. Still, though, ending the week slightly higher on the weekly charts, with the September beans sitting at $6.50, up 5 3/4 on the week, and the Noves up 10 3/4 on the week. Let's go ahead and look at the specifics. September wheat, a high on the day at 306, a low of 299.5, settling 301.5, down 4 1/4. December, a high of 319, a low of 312, settling 314.25, down 4 1/2. March, a high of 330, a low of 323, settling 325.25, down 4 1/4. May, a high of 331, a low of 328, settling 330, down 3. July, a high of 335, a low of 331, settling 332.5, down 3. September corn, a high of 225 3/4, a low of 220, settling 220.25, down 5. December, a high of 234 3/4, a low of 228.5, settling 229, down 5. March, a high of 242.5, a low of 236 3/4, settling 237.5, down 4 3/4. May, a high of 248, a low of 242 3/4, settling 243, down 4.5. July, a high of 252.5, a low of 247 3/4, settling 248, down 4. December, a high of 257 3/4, a low of 255, settling 255.5, down 1 1/4. September oats, a high of 141.5, a low of 139, settling 139 3/4, unchanged. December, a high of 150, a low of 146 3/4, settling 147 3/4, up 0.5. September soybeans, a high of 621, a low of 595.5, settling $6.50, down 16 1/4. November, a high of 611, a low of 589.5, settling 595 3/4, down 10 3/4. January, a high of 617, a low of 596.5, settling 601.5, down 10 1/4. March, a high of 620, a low of 602.5, settling 607.5, down 10. May, a high of 623, a low of 607, settling 611.5, down 8. And July beans, a high of 626, a low of 612, settling 617.5, down 7. September soybean meal, a high of 185.80, a low of 179, settling 179.40, down 640. October, a high of 178.70, a low of 173, settling 174.10, down 410. September soybean oil, a high of 25.05, a low of 24.32, settling 24.40, down 52. And the October contract, a high of 24.65, a low of 23.88, settling 24.01, make that 24.04, down 41 on the day. The settlement prices are also in from the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, where, Celeste, it does appear it was a mixed day today.
Yeah, the lean hogs today finished higher, but otherwise, I would say it was a lower day, but lean hogs did finish higher today. Let's begin with September feeder cattle. The high today, 112.65, the low 112 even, the settlement 112.10, that was up 10 cents. October feeder cattle, 109.50, the high 108.75, the low 108.82.5, the settlement, that down 40. November, 108.15, the high 107.50, the low, the settlement 107.65, that down 15. August live cattle, 83.30, the high, 82.57.5, the low of the settlement, 82.87.5, that up a nickel. September live cattle opened a limit down at 83.50 and finished $2 off down the limit. October live cattle, 83.55, the high, 82.70, the low, 82.85, the settlement, that down 20. October lean hog, 64 even, the high, 63.27.5, the low, the settlement, 63.72.5, up 75. December, 62 even, the high, 61.20, the low, 61.95, the settlement, that up 77.5. February, 61.15, the high, 60.50, the low, 60.82.5, the settlement, that up 12.5. April lean hog, 60.50, the high, 60.05, the low, finishing at 60.30, up 30 cents. And February pork bellies, 93.82.5, the high, the low, 92.10. 92.10, the settlement, that down 97.5. The Dow up 37 points at 10,211. The NASDAQ 13 higher at 1866. And the S&P 500 up 4 points at 1109.
The Carl Center for Rural Health and Farm Safety is proud to underwrite agricultural programming on WILL. The center helps residents of rural communities with education and training in farm safety. For more information, call 217-383-4606.
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science. So let's ask Dr. Science.
That's me.
Remember, he knows more than you do.
That's right.
Mike Bryant from Tampa, Florida writes, "Dear Dr. Science, what would be a good summary about describing photosynthesis without going into the nitty-gritty? What are photosynthetic pigments and how do they relate to photosynthesis, including reflection, transmission, and absorption?"
Describing complicated systems without going into the nitty-gritty is what science writing is all about. And contrary to popular belief, this show is written before it's recorded. Yes, although it may not seem so, I'm just not improvising up here. These are scripted facts written on a word processor and internationally agreed upon ASCII code. But getting back to your question, photosynthetic pigments are a cheaper form of paint. Spend the extra money and go for oils or acrylics. Use gesso to get a reflective surface, and your pictures will glow with virtual life.
Thank you, Dr. Science. Send your science questions to Ask Dr. Science. Remember, he's not a real doctor.
I have a master's degree
in science.
Produced by Duck's Breath. To order the Dr. Science Smug Pack with I Know More Than You Do mug, T-shirt and tape, $29.95, call 800-989-DUCK.
Today's broadcast is made possible in part by a grant from Horene's Pianos Plus, your Steinway Piano Showroom in Bloomington. Horene's Pianos Plus offers new and pre-owned pianos by Steinway & Sons, Boston by Steinway, and other fine pianos.
Don't miss your chance to win one of 10 major prizes in the WILL sweepstakes, each worth $1,000 or more. A widescreen, high-definition TV from Champagne Audio, a Dell computer, a lounge chair and ottoman from Carter's Furniture, or a $1,000 gift certificate from Corley Photography.